colleague of ours here in Sydney, as well as bi-located up in Griffith University in Brisbane. Rachel's going to be talking to us on two kinds of truth in expressivism.
Good. So here's what I aim to cover, and I'm probably not going to cover all of it. So first, I'm going to go through the problem that Jamie Dreyer calls creeping minimalism. A lot of others of you call it other things. But I'll tell you how to get into the problem and kind of what motivates your getting in. And I think I'm going to mention the Frege-Geech problem here, because I think it has a lot to do with what ultimately happens. And I'll suggest a way of getting out that involves distinguishing between two kinds of truth, a correspondence kind and a minimalist kind. I'll then argue that this distinction between two different kinds of truth has semantic applications for expressivists. So I argue that whether you do your expressivist semantics in terms of bifurcated semantics the way Mark does, in terms of worlds and norms the way Alan Gibbert does, or at least used to, and or in terms of deontic modals, which is kind of a version of something proposed by Simon Blackburn, although he can argue with me about that in the Q&A. You can use this distinction, and it sort of makes sense. I'll then have, if there's time, some further methodological thoughts about how far you should go towards solving the Frege-Geech problem, and some further logical thoughts on something bifurcated semantics can do for you if you are a supervaluationist. Probably won't get there, and then I'll conclude. So that's the overview. So now for the problem of creeping minimalism. I'll start by saying what I take expressivism to be, or what I take an interesting form of expressivism to be, and creeping minimalism is going to be a problem for this. So I take it to have three sort of intuitively appealing commitments. First of all, I take expressivists to be committed to a sort of metaphysical anti-realism about moral stuff. So there aren't really any moral properties. And most of the moral assertions people make, like murder is wrong, are not strictly speaking true, because there's nothing in the world that could really answer to them. So that's the first thesis. Second thesis, semantic anti-realism. So what look like moral assertions don't actually make truth evaluable claims. Rather, their job is to do something like express desire-like attitudes. And of course, expressivists will need to say a bit more about what that function is exactly that they play. So we've got metaphysical anti-realism, semantic anti-realism, and finally, an anti-eliminativism about moral talk. So our use of moral language is largely acceptable as it is, maybe with some slight revisions. So good. So that's the version of expressivist that I take myself to be presenting a problem for. Now, I think that creeping minimalism comes out of solutions to the Frege-Geech problem. And I know everybody thinks they know what the Frege-Geech problem is, but I'm not sure that I do. So I have three versions of it. And I think they're all different. So first, there's a problem with validity. We treat some arguments about moral matters as valid and others as invalid. According to the expressivist anti-eliminativism, this practice is acceptable as it is. It sort of makes sense. According to the expressivist semantic anti-realism, though, the premises and conclusions of arguments about morality are not, strictly speaking, truth evaluable. But validity is truth preservation, I would have thought. How can there be valid arguments whose premises don't admit of truth or falsity? How can we distinguish between arguments about morality that are valid and arguments about morality that aren't if there's no truth to preserve? So that is one version of the Frege-Geech problem. Here's sort of the Frege-Geech problem too, a different kind of related problem. So a problem with embedding in truth functional contexts. We use sentences like grass is green and murder is wrong, or murder is wrong and stealing is wrong. According to anti-eliminativism, which is an expressivist commitment, this practice is largely acceptable as it is. These sentences do something really good for us. And is a truth function, so is or. So might be if then on some versions of views about conditionals. But according to semantic anti-realism, murder is wrong is not truth evaluable. So what is and doing here? How can a sentence that is not truth evaluable be meaningfully embedded in a truth functional, or in a sentence that uses a truth functional compound? So we need some story about truth functions that doesn't invoke truth. So we've got a problem with validity, a problem with truth functions. Note that these are not the same problem, although they interact. So you can have valid arguments containing truth functional compounds with moral bits in them. Here's a third Frege-Geech problem. A problem with embedding in non-truth functional contexts. So we use sentences like, even if we had approved of murder, it would still, or sorry, if, even if we had not, yes, so even if we had approved of murder, it would still have been wrong. I've got that right. I wish murder were not wrong, because the guy sitting next to me is really annoying me. John believes that murder is wrong, so I'd better not murder him in front of John. That sort of thing. And it seems like these sentences are largely acceptable. And we want to get some of them to come out right. So we want sort of the first of those up on the slides. Even if we had approved of murder, it would still have been wrong to come out as true. And it's really tough to evaluate an adequate theory of these sentences, or sorry, develop an adequate theory of these sentences that evaluates the right ones as true and the right ones as false. So that's a third version of the Frege-Geech problem. You might think that's a version of the Frege-Geech problem because it involves embedding of sentences about wrongness and goodness in larger sentences. But note that it's not a problem with validity and it's not a problem with truth functions. So that's sort of the background on expressivism. Now I'm going to give you minimalism, and then I'm going to sort of make it creep and take over expressivism. So minimalists about truth believe that the concept of truth is nothing above and beyond what's captured by the T schemas. So this is a pretty catch-all definition of minimalism, and there are lots of subtleties that I'm glossing over here. Here's a T schema for you. P is true if and only if P, where the thing in corner quotes might be replaced by sort of a thing in triangle brackets to represent it being a proposition. I've got the sentential version there. I'm going to add that maybe you should throw in the definitions of truth functional connectives if you're a minimalist, as well as the T schemas, because you need to understand sort of what if and only if means, for starters. And I don't think that this sort of goes against the spirit of minimalism. So that's what minimalists think. So what it is for P to be true is just for it to be the P. And there's really not much more to truth than that. So now we're going to get the minimalism to creep. Because of their anti-eliminativism, expressivists are committed to moral claims like murder is wrong. If you don't think murder is wrong, substitute shellfish as an abomination or whatever you do think. So, good. Minimalists are also committed to the following thesis. Murder is wrong is true, if and only if murder is wrong. So it looks like expressivists who are also minimalists are committed to this. Murder is wrong is true. But the expressivist was supposed to be a metaphysical anti-realist. They were supposed to say things like, most of the sentences that we assert about morality are not, strictly speaking, true. So for instance, murder is wrong is one of those sentences that were supposed to come out as not strictly speaking true. But now we've got sort of a set of commitments that contradicts the original set of commitments. So it looks like if you are trying to be both an expressivist and a minimalist about truth, you are going to quickly run into a set of contradictory commitments. And even in Australia, this seems bad. So this is the problem. How do you get out? So I see three ways out. I like doing things in threes. First way out. You could give up expressivism. I'll assume that we don't want to do this because this is an expressivism conference. So I'm just going to leave this option aside. Second way out is to go global. So say something like, well, there's really, the original problem assumed that there was some sort of distinction between things that were really strictly speaking true and things that were only expressive. And this is the wrong sort of distinction to be drawing. We should really be talking about something else. And I think this is a plausible way to go, but it sort of threatens to rob the original expressivist view that I started with of its content. So the original expressivist view was, as Mike was pointing out yesterday, sort of motivated by the thought there's something especially problematic about evaluative sentences, in particular, usually moral sentences. So we have stuff in the world that seems to answer to sentences like, this room has tables and chairs in it. We don't seem to have stuff in the world that could possibly answer to sentences like murder is wrong or make them true. So I think that motivating thought is what sort of brought on the metaphysical anti-realism and perhaps the semantic anti-realism as well. So global expressivists say a lot of interesting things, but I'm not sure that they're about the kind of expressivism that I originally had in mind and that creeping minimalism was a problem for. So another way to put this is that global expressivism seems tantamount to giving up the original expressivism that you started out with. And maybe that's more popular than just saying outright, I'm giving it up. But I still think it's a problem. So here's a third option that I want to explore. Give up minimalism. And I'm going to recommend this option for expressivists. So, all right, I need to say more about how to give up minimalism. Just denying it doesn't seem very helpful because minimalism looked plausible on the face of it. I say give up minimalism by distinguishing two kinds of truth or two rules for truth. So minimalist truth, you might think, is what satisfies the T schemas and is used to define connectives in truth tables. So if you have a concept of minimalist truth, then you can do logic. You can disquote, and that's all fine and good. You might think there's a stronger concept of correspondence truth. So it has something to do with matching between representations in the world. So when I say there are lots of red chairs in this room, the world is somehow expected to match that. So and if the world doesn't answer properly to my saying there are lots of red chairs in the room, then I've done something wrong. This is still a bit hazy. Here's another thought. It involves direction of fit. So when I say there are lots of red chairs in the room, and then I discover that there aren't, what I'm meant to do is to be giving up the mental state that sort of represented there being lots of red chairs in the room. When I say you ought to go shut the door and you don't, what I ought to be doing is to be trying to keep the mental state and change the world and make you go shut the door. So that's still a bit hazy, but a little bit more about correspondence truth. Here's another reason you might think that there's something more to truth than just minimalist truth. So I can believe, desire, hope, or intend that P. The circumstances under which my belief that P is accurate, so my belief that I have a new pet kitten is accurate, are the same as the circumstances under which my desires and hopes that I have a new pet kitten are satisfied, my intention that I have a new pet kitten is realized. So it looks like we can have lots of different representational states toward the same content, and that's something for correspondence contents to be doing. One last thing about correspondence contents that isn't on the slide. I got the distinction from literature on vagueness, where some supervaluationists, Brian McLaughlin and Van McGee, smooth, yeah, propose that in cases of vague predicates, like bald, we should distinguish between disquotational truth and minimalist truth. So the idea is something like, somebody is bald. Okay, so we've got a language. We've got a vague word bald in it. It's not, there's no fact of the matter about where we ought to be drawing the line between bald people and non-bald people. There are many acceptable places to draw the line. There are also some unacceptable places to draw the line. Somebody counts as bald just in case on every acceptable way of drawing the line between bald and not bald, they count as bald. So it's really true that they're bald, just in case, no matter how we juggle around between bald and not bald, they come out as bald. So in that sense of true, their being bald corresponds to something in the world about the amount of hair they have. But there's another sense of true in which we get to sort of decide whether it's true that they're bald or not, based on how we divide up the people between bald and not bald. So we've got somebody who's a borderline case of bald. We can just sort of deem him bald. And then it counts. So, and then in that language, he's bald, and it counts as true that he's bald this quotationally. But it's not as though we're answering to the world in deeming him bald. So you might think that there's a similar thing that we can do in expressivism, where sort of I can deem murder wrong by expressing disapproval of it. I'm not answering to any properties of murder, because there's no wrongness for me to be answering to. So what I said is not correspondence true, but it is disquotationally, or I'm at least, I'm committed to saying it's disquotationally true because I'm committed to it, so, or minimally true. Good. So there's some thoughts about the distinction. So sorry, yes, I've missed this bit about correspondence truth. So going back to the beliefs, desire, and intentions, you might say that my belief, desire, and intention, and so forth, relating to my having a new kitten, are relations to the same content whose truth value is satisfied by the world. So that's the content whose truth value is satisfied by the world. Good. All right, so now I'm going to argue that this distinction between correspondence truth and minimalist truth has sort of a place in expressivist logic, and that this is true no matter which of three appealing expressivist logics you choose. And I'm also going to sort of, while I do this, argue that the expressivist logics are not quite as different as they looked in the first place. So that's the next step. So semantic I've got a little bit more to say about correspondence truth and minimalist truth. So here's a conjecture. Everything that's correspondence true is also minimalist true, but not everything that's minimalist true is correspondence true. So assuming that P is false, just in case not P is true, it's going to turn out that everything is correspondence false. That is correspondence false is also going to be minimalist false. And not everything that's minimalist false is going to be correspondence false. So every minimalist truth value gap is going to be contained in a correspondence truth value gap. And this is going to come out true in all of the expressivist logics we look at. So that'll be cool. All right, now on to the semantic applications. I'm going to start with Marx's bifurcated semantics, which he has very nicely introduced you to in the previous talk. So say I've got a sentence P. This expresses the content of being for some function of P, and also being for some other function of P, where F1 and F2 take in the sentence P, spit out properties, and the property expressed by F1 of P, picked out by F1 of P, is, in the book you said, at least as strong. In the talk you said, strictly stronger than the property picked out by F2 of P. So, good. So if the sentence P is purely descriptive, then F1 and F2 are built out of atomic propositions, or properties, sorry, of the form proceeding as if P, and I'm going to abbreviate that PAI, just as Mark does, for various propositions P. So either grass is green or my eyes deceive me expresses the attitude of, first of all, being for proceeding as if grass is green or proceeding as if my eyes deceive me, and second of all, being for proceeding as if grass isn't green or proceeding as if my eyes don't deceive me. So I'm not going to go through the compositional semantics for that. So for not proceeding as if grass isn't green or not proceeding as if my eyes don't deceive me. So yes, I think I read it out incorrectly. Yes, good. So it's what it says on the slide, not what I said. What about sort of non-descriptive or partially non-descriptive sentences? They're going to have some atomic properties in them that aren't of the form proceeding as if something is true. So either grass is green or murder is wrong expresses the property of being for proceeding as if grass is green or blaming murder, and also being for not proceeding as if grass is not green, or I say blaming murder, I think Marx got might put something different in the second place. So, good. So, this all making sense? Cool. All right. I claim that there are two kinds of contents in bifurcated semantics. This shouldn't be news to you after the last talk, but we'll go through it anyway. So here's the sentence, either grass is green or my eyes deceive me. Here's the sentence, either grass is green or murder is wrong. They've both got their kind of bifurcated translations below them. So all right, here's one way of picking out contents. You go within the scope of the for operator. So I've got, so Mark calls the kind of first content in every ordered pair the major content, the major attitude, and second, the minor attitude. So I've just put them in different colors so you can see which is first and which is second. So those are candidate contents. Things that I am for doing. Here's another, and they're built out of smaller candidate contents that are also things that I can be for doing. Here's another way of picking out contents. You can kind of go within the scope of the proceeding as if, or in the case of murder is wrong, you can go within the scope of the blaming. So these are things that I am for proceeding as if they are so. So they're propositions such that I'm for proceeding as if they're so. Or they are things that I am for having certain attitudes toward. So these look like two kinds of contents, and now I want to line them up with correspondence and disquotational truth. So here's a suggestion. The contents within the scope of the for operator admit of minimalist truth. So going back up here. Yep. So these guys admit of minimalist truth. They can be combined using truth functions. And when I assert that what Marx said is true, whether it was about morality or about grass, and I try to assert it in a disquotational way, what I'm doing is endorsing, I'm sort of urging whatever, whichever of these contents Mark urged you to do. So it looks like they're candidates for minimalist truth. I want to say that the contents within the scope of the proceeding as if operator admit of correspondence truth. So going back up, grass is green is kind of either a way the world can be or a way the world can fail to be. And if I am for proceeding as if grass is green when it isn't, then I'm favoring something that fails to correspond to the world. So, and the contents within the scope of the proceeding as if operator also admit of minimalist truth in the following extended sense. You accept P as minimalist true if you are for proceeding as if P. So we have every correspondence truth also being a minimalist truth, or at least capable of minimalist truth, but not vice versa. So that's how bifurcated semantics works with this distinction. All right, next I'm going to go on to sort of possible world semantics, the way that Alan Gibbard does them. And I'm going to go there via bifurcated semantics. So a proposition can be picked out as the set of possible worlds where it's true. So many objects of belief are propositions in this sense. Some contents don't quite correspond to propositions. So the content of the belief that I'm Rachel Briggs or the content of the desire to get rich, you might think don't correspond to propositions because I can truly believe them or desire them. So I can truly believe that I am Rachel Briggs. Laura can falsely believe that she is Rachel Briggs. I can unsatisfiedly desire that I get rich. You can satisfiedly desire that he get rich. So it looks like the contents of these guys don't correspond to propositions, but to properties. So one way of doing the logic with these guys is to use what are called centered propositions, which are propositions plus sort of. So propositions are sets of worlds, or I'm thinking of them this way. Centered propositions are sets of worlds plus a location in the world picked out. So this world is a world. This world with me highlighted is a centered world, or this world with you highlighted is a centered world. So that's possible worlds. I haven't gotten you to norms yet. So I'm going to get you to norms via bifurcated semantics. One last thought about centered propositions. You might expect them to be closely related to action. So I'm pushing, here's an example from John Perry. I'm pushing a shopping cart, and I notice that there's a trail of sugar on the floor. And I sort of form a bunch of true beliefs about the world. So I think, gosh, there's some idiot whose shopping cart is leaking sugar. I'm going to follow the trail. And I sort of form more and more beliefs. I see sort of on the security camera some woman whose shopping cart is leaking sugar. I think, you know, that woman, her shopping cart is leaking sugar. God, she's got a stylish jacket on, but she really should do something about this shopping cart. And I don't do anything about the fact that my shopping cart is leaking sugar until I realize that woman whose shopping cart is leaking sugar, who has a stylish jacket on, who looks like that on the security camera, is me. And once I've got a centered world picked out, then I can sort of use sort of all the uncentered information I've got for action. So you might think that there's some close link between centered propositions and action, and that therefore you would expect there to be some close link between centered propositions and whatever theory of normativity you've got. So, good. So here I'm going to sort of talk a bit about how you get from bifurcation to world norm pairs, and the norms are going to be represented in terms of centered worlds. So here's either grass is green or my eyes deceive me, again. So here's sort of the first attitude. I'm for proceeding as if grass is green or proceeding as if my eyes deceive me. Here, I've drawn logical space for you. So here's, or I've actually drawn centered logical space. So here's a space of centered worlds. And you can think of being for doing these things as bearing an attitude toward a set of centered worlds, namely worlds where somebody is doing these things and the center is pointing to that somebody, or one of those somebodies, if there are multiple somebodies doing those things. So I've picked out a subspace of the set of centered worlds. And I mean these to be centered worlds where the center is really opinionated as to how they're proceeding. So take whatever language you are interested in speaking. Has a bunch of atomic sentences. These centered worlds are just centered worlds in which the center is opinionated about all of those atomic sentences. So here is, in green, the left rectangle is the people who proceed as if grass is green. The right rectangle is people who proceed as if their eyes deceive them. They overlap. So the dark green bit is the overlap. So, you know, there's the set of people who either proceed as if grass is green or proceed as if their eyes deceive them. Some of them are really opinionated, some of them are not really opinionated. Here's second attitude. I'm also for not proceeding as if grass isn't green and not proceeding as if my eyes don't deceive me. So in blue, the people who... So everybody who proceeds as if grass is green doesn't proceed as if grass isn't green. And everybody who proceeds as if their eyes deceive me doesn't proceed as if their eyes don't deceive them. So I've got blue rectangles representing people who don't proceed as if grass isn't green, people who don't proceed as if their eyes don't deceive them. And notice that these completely overlap the original green rectangles. So here's the people who do one or the other. We've got a set of in this highlighted rectangle representing people who are really opinionated, we've got a set of people who proceed in all the appropriate ways. We can map this highlighted rectangle onto a space of uncentered worlds, namely the uncentered worlds where actually what happens is that each point in this rectangle gets mapped onto an uncentered world where everything the person in the centered world takes to be true is in fact true. So the world is exactly as they proceed as if it were. So I claim that if this sort of blue, if the sort of blue-green rectangle represents, in the case of a purely descriptive sentence, if the blue-green rectangle represents the state of proceeding as if you are for being in, or the set of states of proceeding as if you are for being in, then sort of the blue-green rectangle gets mapped to on the right represents the set of worlds compatible with your belief. and your beliefs, and those, that's the set of uncentered worlds. So we've got a mapping from bifurcated semantics to possible world semantics in the case of purely descriptive sentences. What happens when we throw normative sentences into the mix? So consider the sentence, either grass is green or murder is wrong. So that expresses the attitude of for proceeding as if grass is green, or normative sentence, blaming murder. So again, here's the space of centered worlds. Here's the subspace where in which the centers are sort of maximally opinionated relative to whatever language you care about. Here are the people who proceed as if grass is green or blame murder. Here are the people who don't proceed as if grass isn't green and blaming murder is already represented. Now, because the points in this rectangle have a bit of extra information, they represent not just what the person is for proceeding as if, but also what the person is for doing. We can no longer map this highlighted rectangle onto the space of uncentered worlds. But if we just add a little bit of information to each point, so we take each point to represent not just what the world is like according to somebody's beliefs, but also what ought to be done or what is prescribed, then we can map this subspace of centered worlds onto a set of world norm pairs. And the norms tell you what you ought to do. Here's a suggestion about world norm pairs. Sets of world norm pairs admit of minimalist truth. Sets of worlds admit of correspondence truth. No surprises there. So once again, we have a distinction between minimalist truth and correspondence truth. Less surprising, more surprising is that apparently really different from bifurcated semantic picture maps on, I think, to the bifurcated semantic picture. So one last logical, expressivist logic in which one can use the distinction between minimalist truth and correspondence truth. And that's sort of deontic modals. So I talked about world norm pairs. You might wonder, what are norms exactly? So if we stick to the concept of wrong, then norms should correspond to sets of properties of the form blaming P. That's what they corresponded to in the formalism given just then. A perspicuous way to capture this is as follows. You can think of a norm as a complete set of actions that one is for blaming, so a set containing only all and only the actions that one is for blaming. This only worked for wrong. You've got to do other things for other moral concepts. So we can then think of wrong and permissible as modal operators of a weird sort. Phiing is permissible according to some world. That should say if and only if. If and only if it happens at some deontically accessible centered worlds, and wrong if and only if it happens at no deontically accessible centered worlds. So we can have a modal operator where what's playing the role of worlds is not, you know, possible worlds, but centered possible worlds. And the acceptable ones of those correspond to the permissible actions. So you could also have the context of your beliefs corresponding to sets of centered worlds instead of sets of uncentered worlds. I've had them corresponding to sets of uncentered worlds, which means that the worlds of your beliefs are not the same as the deontically accessible worlds of wrongness and permissibility. I think that's all right. So you just end up admitting that the actual world is not a possible world. Lots of people think that. But the point when it comes to truth is that sets of world-centered world pairs, you might think, admit a minimalist truth. Or sorry, sets of world, set of centered world pairs admit of minimalist truth. And sets of worlds admit of correspondence truth. So once again, you've got this distinction. So let's see. I haven't got that much time, so I'm going to skip the further logical thoughts. Have I got time for the further methodological thoughts, or should I wrap it up?
How long will it take?
I'll wrap it up. All right.
You've had 40 minutes.
Sorry. All right. Okay. Yeah. So I'll do the further methodological thoughts. Excellent. Given any of these formalisms, there's a worry about whether expressivists can completely solve the Frege-Gitsch problem. It looks like all of these formalisms completely solve the Frege-Gitsch problem one. So that was the problem about validity. So if we've got a concept of minimalist truth, then we can let validity be minimalist truth preservation. The Frege-Gitsch problem two is a problem about truth functional compounds. And it looks like all of these formalisms solve the problem of truth functional compounds, because the bifurcated formalism solves it by translating all truth functional compounds in sentence form to complicated things involving truth functional compounds of properties. The other two translate truth functional compounds into set theoretic notions of intersection, complementation, and union. So we end up with a solution to the second Frege-Gitsch problem. But the third Frege-Gitsch problem about embedding in non-truth functional contexts raises some additional difficulties. So here's a way of pointing towards some of the problems. So here are a couple of worries about bifurcated semantics that Mark is probably solving. What is it to suspend judgment about whether murder is wrong? We can talk about that in the Q&A. What is it to hope that murder is not wrong? So bifurcated semantics has trouble with these kinds of constructions. There are some worries about deontic modals. So if it's permissible to feed the poor, is it permissible that somebody be poor? It looks like the wrong answer is yes, but that's the answer that sort of working with deontic modals gives you. What is it for somebody's character to be virtuous? How do you capture that with a deontic modal? That's a problem. I'm not aware of any problems for the semantics of world norm pairs that are like this with the third Frege-Gitsch problem, but let me know in the Q&A if you are. So there are additional problems. You might wonder whether expressivists should completely solve the Frege-Gitsch problem. So I think this is a question that people haven't asked much and maybe should ask. One way around sort of these versions of the Frege-Gitsch problem three is to develop more logical machinery. Another is to be slightly revisionists and say that some things make less sense than we thought. So if there's nothing in the world that answers to murders being wrong or murders not being wrong, does it really make sense to hope that murder is not wrong? It's not clear. And the first two Frege-Gitsch problems sort of threaten much more of moral assertoric practice than the third one. So this is an open line. This is kind of an open question, and I think people often don't treat it as one. So there's a question about where the goalpost should be. And here's a thought about an advantage of the slightly revisionist approach. It's sometimes well-motivated by an expressivist outlook, as it possibly is in the case of hoping, I think. And it makes expressivism strong enough to be interesting. So there's a worry about trivializing expressivism, and if expressivism is yielding sort of real and well-motivated predictions, then it's not so clear that that's a bad thing. So I'm going to skip the logical thoughts about supervaluationism and conclude. So we can stop creeping minimalism by rejecting minimalism. Expressivist semantics has a place for a non-minimal correspondence concept of truth in addition to the minimal one. And this is true, I think, no matter what kind of semantics you're using, restricted to the three kinds that I think are appealing. Different kinds of expressivist semantics aren't as different as they seem. And finally, there is more than one Frege-Gitsch problem, and not all of these problems are of equal severity.
Thank you, Rachel, and I'm sorry about all the sneezing. Yes, Mark first.
So a couple small comments. So one comment is that I agree that the problem, I mean, there's a problem for bifurcated attitude semantics about other attitudes. I think it's a problem for everybody. I mean, to some extent, I'm not an advocate of bifurcated attitude semantics, but I think it does do some things well. And I think it at least makes room for seeing how to approach other attitude verbs like post-that and wonders whether and so on. Because insofar as you have a candidate to be the object of those attitudes, that's these pairs of properties, there's at least a place to start, and you can explain lots of things straight up about why it is that if you hope that murder's wrong, and I believe that murder's wrong, and he said that murder's wrong, that there's something that you hope and I believe he said, and we talk about whether it's true or false and so on. So I see some resources there that I don't see in the frameworks that don't have the candidate to be the objects of each of those kinds of attitudes. Second thought. So, just real quickly. So, you say we should get rid of minimalism. And I think, yes, it's all very elegant. There's something there that could be correspondence truth. Separate question, whether the thing that could be correspondence truth deserves to be called truth. Maybe, you know, that's what correspondence theorists were getting at. But maybe that's just not what the word true means in the language. And so I don't think that to avoid the creeping, you need to have this pre-theoretical notion in order to make a distinction between the essentially expressive discourse and the non-essentially expressive discourse. I think that there could be something intra-theoretic once you've got the theory on the table, that the theory makes some distinctions that are intra-theoretical distinctions that nevertheless look like the important ones. So like you might think that the difference in structure between the perceived as if things and the non-perceived as if things is not something that we have these terms to talk about before, like representational, or you might think those words all get this minimalist gloss. Yet within the theory, it has no structure that we can point some things out that that we could say, yeah, you're right about what the difference is, but wrong that we can't be minimalist about truth all the way down the line, because the real notion of truth, the one in English, is that.
So good. So the first thought was about hoping and compliment-taking attitudes. I think you're right that bifurcated semantics has potential because it has something to play the role of objects of hope or other complimenting attitudes. I'm not sure why that's not also the case with something like Gibbard semantics. So Gibbard has sets of world norm pairs, and those look like they are the objects of sort of belief in the extended sense. So why couldn't they also be the objects of hope? Or even sort of used to construct, say, something like questions. So if you think that what questions do is they chop logical space into the equivalence class of their possible answers, then you might think that with Gibbard, the equivalence class, sets of worlds that are equivalent, that are equivalence classes with respect to possible answers to the question. So the question, is Snow white, chops logical space into the worlds where Snow is white, and the answer is yes, and the worlds where Snow is not white, and the answer is no, and leave out worlds for now where it's indeterminate whether Snow is white. So you might think that if you're Gibbard, you can say, is murder wrong, chops sort of the space of world norm pairs into the world norm pairs that count murder as wrong and the world norm pairs that do not.
I think that's incompatible with Gibbard's philosophical understanding of what the world norm pairs do. Is that I think that in his framework, they're not contents of attitudes, they're representations of attitudes in terms of their disagreement properties.
Right.
So like if you think about hyperplanners, the hyperplanners have contents that are about all the other hyperplanners. That's not exactly right, but we can use hyperplanners to characterize other states in terms of which hyperplanet they disagree with. So I think it's more of a representation of the disagreement properties than
You're probably right about Gibbard.
If it could be the content, that's true.
Right. So I see that there are worries about sort of Gibbard's philosophical position. Your second question about sort of why call this correspondency thing truth? Why not say that there's truth and then there's sort of correspondence and they both have an important theoretical role? I'm not sure whether to be fussed about that or not. So you might think, call it whatever you like. It's there, it's being motivated by some of the correspondence intuitions that the people originally used to motivate things like correspondence theories of truth. It is close enough. And in fact, that's basically what I want to say, is that it bears sort of enough conceptual connections to the way people have used the word truth in the past that it's good enough to be doing what I want to do.
Yeah, another mark.
So I got to worry about for the cases where you have both minimalist truth and correspondence truth, about the motivations of having both. It kind of picks up on the question Mark just asked. Typically, minimalists want to say things like T-schema gives you, you know, once you've got all kind of instances of T-schema, that kind of, that's it for the concept of truth, or that there's a complete cognitive equivalence between both sides of the T-schema. Then you want to motivate, for those cases, the kind of correspondence notion, which you bring in notions like direction of fit, or grounding, or making. So it seems like there isn't a cognitive equivalence between both sides of T-schema.
Right.
Or that there is more to be said about. I mean, if in the correspondence case, it is some genuine notion of truth for at least those cases. It seems there's more to be said about truth. So it seems that, you know, if you're going to want to call them genuine cases of some notion of truth, then you're going to reject minimalism.
Good. Yes. So I think I do want to reject minimalism. And the question is, Why did I think minimalism was motivating in the first place, if I don't think that there's a cognitive equivalence between the two sides of the T-schema or anything like that? So is that a fair way of recasting your question, or is that...
So you'll accept the T-schema. It just seems odd to say that for cases which are correspondence true, they're also minimally true. Mm-hmm. Because what you mean by minimally true is some concept which is completely cashed out by all instances of the T-schema.
Right, so I'm saying that there are two truth properties, and that sort of necessarily anything that's in the extension of the correspondence truth property is also in the extension of the minimalist truth property. So I'm not saying that they're the same property. Is this answering?
So I was thinking that.
And they're both candidate things to be called truth. Even so I don't think the minimalist is right that the T-schemas exhaust the concept of. The sort of the pre-theoretic concept of truth. So I have to reject that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I've got a couple of fingers on this point. First one, Mike. Second from Simon.
So I think just to follow up on that, I mean, one thing I was interested in is, I mean, I want to say that, as was just rehearsed, everything that's correspondence true is minimalist true, and not everything that's minimalist true is correspondence true. And are you just stipulating the first principle, or do you think that, I mean, because there would be worries, I think, that that's just not true. For the first principle to be true, it seems like there's got to be some sort of substitutivity between correspondence truth and is corresponding to P and T or something like that. And it's not really clear. I mean, I'm just not really clear why you were accepting the first principle.
So I was thinking it was a desideratum, actually. So I was thinking that, you know, if sort of the world tells you that P, in whatever correspondence sense that you want to use that, then it had better be okay to say that it's true that P. So I was thinking of correspondence truth as being something like, you know, P, and furthermore, that's settled by the world and not by my stipulation.
Right. But there might be reasons. In fact, I think there are reasons. I think there are reasons to think that maybe you can't really, there isn't an equivalence between, there isn't any sort of way of strong equivalence between correspondence that P and, or P is corresponding to the world, mm-hmm. and E. And if that's the case, then if there's some reasons for thinking that, I think there are a lot of different reasons.
Right.
That you're not going to necessarily get, if correspondence true, then minimalist true.
Right.
That's one reason to think that, you know, when people talk about this sort of truth pluralism, you know, where you've got pluralism is really thin concept and then a thick some maybe more than one thick concept, that you've got a problem. You know, there's a sort of general line of rejection to this sort of, you know.
Here's a cheap trick that you might try. So you might say, look, something is correspondence true, just in case it is minimalist true, and it is minimalist true sort of in virtue of its corresponding to the world. So that will guarantee that everything is correspondence true only if it's minimalist true. And it won't tell you yet whether everything that's minimalist true is correspondence true.
I think that's a good, definitely a good direction to go in. And I mean, just one thing you could have said, obviously, to Mark would be that to try to say, well, what instead of going, well, these are just two different notions, right? And, you know, I don't really care what the one. I mean, it seems like, in a sense, you do care because you were just articulating some, you know, a way, taking that sort of answer that you were just giving and trying to flush out why it is that both of these things count as, in some sense, well, playing the same role. There's more than you can say.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Simon, the finger on this one.
Yes, it was really overlapping with what Mike just said. I mean, you know, you can think of true as admitting a verbal qualification, something mathematically true or environmentally true if it's involved with the representation in the sense that you were giving it last night, without thereby bifurcating truth. I mean, you just say, yeah, it's minimally true. And that it's minimally true because of something about mathematics, because of something about psychology, because of something about the subject matter. And it seems to me that's a much cleaner way of doing it, because apart from anything else, if you've got different notions of truth, like correspondence true, you know, you face Frege's regress. You know, if P is correspondence true, is the proposition that P is correspondence true, is all correspondence true, and so on up. And if correspondence true is a thick concept, then that's going to be a different proposition at each stage of regress. That's unbelievable. So it seems to me that you want, you do much better than to keep a single notion of truth, which is why I'm a deflationist now.
So I'll say a thing about Frege's regress. I'm not committed to the claim that correspondence truth always satisfies the T schemas. So you might think it can be P without its being correspondence true that P.
No, I understand.
Yeah, so...
But if it's correspondence true that P, then correspondence truth is correspondence true that P.
I think that's another one that's probably going to get violated. So the worry is something like, why call this truth at all? So I may be repeating myself here, but I guess I'm going to have to reject the claim that the concept of truth is wholly exhausted by the T schema. And I think there are sort of good, sort of speak with the folk pre-theoretic reasons for doing this. So you might think that, we're talking about whether a particular science fiction film is bad. You say it is, I say it isn't. And we can disagree, but it seems a bit weird for me to get upset with you because what you said wasn't true. You might think that I'm sort of failing to play the game properly there, even though we disagree. So I might, and similarly, I could be upset with you for other reasons, but not for that reason. And similarly, if you say let's go to the opera, I say let's go to the next science fiction film. I can get upset with you, but not because you lied to me. That's not a going reason to get upset with you. So.
Okay, I think we'd better go back to the main queue at this point. So, Tamer.
Hopefully this is a Dorothy Dixon question, but I'm not sure. I was just wondering, and I'm asking you because you obviously understand all these different semantic theories, whether there's a puzzle for any of the theories caused by things like morally neutral actions or genuine moral dilemmas. So I was wondering if any of the theories build in excluded middle at the wrong point or the law of non-contradiction at the wrong point.
Excellent. So I think the way that people explain them, they often do. But you can sort of build technical tweaks to get around this. So for instance, if you think of permissibility in terms of deontic modals, and you think of obligation in terms of deontic modals, then let's see. Actually, that's not true. So you can think. Yes. So I might think of obligation in terms of deontic modals, and I might think, look, if I'm obligated to phi, and I'm also obligated to not phi, then I must be obligated to do everything, and that's going to follow if obligation is represented using one deontic modal. You can tinker with the sort of logical structure of that. So you might have, so one thing you can do is you can sort of switch from a normal modal system to a non-normal modal system. That'll do lots of things for you. Another thing you can do is sort of have multiple modal operators. So I guess the answer to your question is yes, a lot of them do build in things like excluded middle and classical logic, but you can work around them if you sort of throw in enough logical fiddly bits. And I'm not sure how the debate ends up. So.
Kristen.
Maybe these points related to two just small thoughts about things you said. A thought. You suggested that there's a direction of fit indicator to distinguish correspondence and minimal truths. And that, first of all, yes, that's interesting. Now I'm not sure it's true. But it seems that for the broad sweep of cases where people are attracted to express these views, the direction of fit will generally go with correspondence story. My colleague gave a very interesting lecture yesterday.
Right.
Okay, and then I get evidence that the audience was bored. Many of them had serious objections to what he said, and didn't respond to the objections properly. And I say, my sense is not that they should be appraised, that reaction. Okay, which is that I was wrong.
Right.
And you can elaborate that kind of thing right across the board. Moral contents, all kinds of evaluations.
Yeah, so I see the worry. One strategy for responding to it would be to say that sort of when you say my colleague gave a very interesting lecture yesterday, you're already assuming a lot of both normative and non-normative things, and what you're doing is trying to make a distinction between sort of the normative plus non-normative possibilities in which your colleague gave an interesting lecture, and the normative plus non-normative possibilities in which they didn't. And you've already got some assumptions about which normative possibilities correspond to which non-normative possibilities. So you think that if the whole audience fell asleep, then it wouldn't be right to be interested in the lecture, or if the person didn't, if the person showed you a bunch of animal pictures instead of giving you an argument, it wouldn't be right to feel interested in the lecture. So, and then by asserting that the lecture was interesting, you're ruling out some non-normative possibilities as well as some normative possibilities. There's going to be a danger about being able to sort of distinguish the normative parts from the non-normative parts of the content. And I don't know what to do about it, but that would be the kind of line I'd try to run.
So the suggestion is that there'll be the correspondence direction fit, just in case what's at stake is the non-normative component.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's okay, I'm a little skeptical.
I'm just going to give myself a finger on that. I mean, after all, there are lots of us who are expressivists about things which have nothing to do with the normative or the evaluative realm.
Right.
Like the modal realm. Aren't those kind of cases going to create a problem for more use of direction of fit?
Right. So what am I meant to be doing or expressing when I'm when I say it's possible that
I might be necessity is perhaps easier because
right.
I might be expressing a kind of habit of making a certain kind of inference or something like that.
Right.
And then possibility is the sort of the jewel of that. It's an indication of leaving open some kind of move or transition.
Right. So I think what I want to say is that if you say it's necessary that that I have the origins I do, then what you're doing is somehow committing yourself to continuing to behave as though I have to proceed as though I have the origins. I see the problem. So you're committing yourself to sort of continuing to proceed as if I have the origins I do under a variety of new circumstances, more than you would be if you just said Rachel has the origins that she in fact does without putting the necessity operator in front of it. So I think the content of that is still to urge me to do something. I'm not sure what to say about this, and I need to think about it more. One thing I might want to do is to sort of resist the expressivism about things like modality in the first place. So that's.
Okay, good. Let's go back to the queue. Kevin, I think you're next.
I'm confused about the suggestion on what's wrong.
So you said you wanted to treat them as geometric model operators, but then in the definition, it seemed like you treated it as a geometric model predicate. So operator would be is wrong that, blah, blah, blah. Predicate would be such and such is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Permissible, it's permissible that would be the operator. Such and such is permissible would be the predicate. So they're defining is permissible, that's a predicate version. But instead you wanted to say you want to treat them as operators. The
right.
Predicate version is going to be really hard on modal semantics because your definition of truth of the world is not going to be an inductive definition anymore. So I find it more natural to think of permissible and wrong as predicates, as I assume you do, and all your examples use them as predicates. But then you want to say you want to find them as operators, that's going to be much weaker. So I was confused about that.
Yeah, so I guess the thought was it is permissible that one phi is kind of the way the operator is supposed to work. So one phi is kind of the sentence or proposition that it's operating on. And then one phi is true not at possible worlds, but at centered worlds. And so it is permissible that one phi is true at a possible world, just in case. So we've got some accessibility relation from possible worlds to centered worlds. It is permissible that one phi is true at a possible world, just in case all the accessible centered worlds are ones at which it is true that one phi is. So it's true. We've got a truth at a world notion and a truth at a centered world notion, and they're different. So your suggestion is, why not just make this into a predicate? A modal predicate. It would be much simpler. I was somehow worried about predicating things of merely possible possibilia, but if you don't have that worry, then
there's standard ways to deal with that,
yeah.
That problem.
So I think I'm going to take that as a friendly suggestion that I may accept. Yeah. So that seems quite reasonable.
Andre, actually, what I wanted to ask takes us back to correspondence truth being sufficient for minimalist truth, and I originally wanted to ask a question, but in response to one here, you answered it. So my question is really about your answer, I guess. The original question was going like this. In the case of minimalist truth, I take it to be necessary as well as sufficient for an assertion, utterance, to be minimalist true, that you have the relevant attitude to the asserted as of being for proceeding as if it's the case. What I was wondering is, what is the argument for saying that if it's correspondence true, necessary condition for it being correspondence true, is that you have that attitude? Now, your response to that, in effect, was to say, well, this may be a cheap trick.
Yes.
Then what we do is we take correspondence truth as you characterized it earlier, given to distinction from minimal truth, and we say, well, correspondence truth really is truth so characterized, if that's the right way to put it, plus, just add on, minimalist truth, yeah?
Right.
And there we get the entail coming out. Now, what I was wondering is, how you respond to somebody who says, well, that's fine, we can do that, but actually, given the characterization you gave of correspondence truth, really that gives us a third notion of truth. Correspondence truth, as you characterized it, comes apart into two notions. And so the question then would be, why can't you say that? And if you can say that, then what is the argument? Well, there's a further question. If you can say that, are you still going to claim that correspondence truth, minus the minimalist component, entails, that's a bad way to put it, but anyway.
So good. So I guess I've given you sort of three things. I've given you minimalist truth. I've given you correspondence, which is sort of intersecting, but neither entailed by nor entailing minimalist truth. And I've given you correspondence truth, which is their intersection. And why is correspondence truth rather than correspondence something we should be worried about?
Well, what's the relation between correspondence?
Right.
If it's a notion of truth and minimalist truth.
So why are these both notions of truth?
Well, is correspondence, as opposed to the compound notion, mm-hmm. a notion, does that give us a notion of truth?
Right.
Does, do you want to say about that notion of truth, that something is correspondence true only if minimally true?
Right, so I guess I'm taking Mike's suggestion that correspondence, so there are things that correspond to the world but aren't minimally true. But there's nothing that's correspondence true that's not minimally true, sort of by cheap trick definition.
And then
I'm going to need to say something further, like correspondence truth is some interesting philosophical jointed nature to be talking about. So I think I need that to make this project work.
A finger from Crispin.
Very quickly, did you mean to accept Andre's suggestion that it suffices to know this truth that the asserter can have the attitude in question?
Yeah,
that's going to last the two positions together.
Well, one thing I was wondering about, sorry, I was wondering whether you might respond by saying, minimalist truth that attaches to assertion, correspondence truth attaches to something else.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that. So I want to say minimalist truth attaches to a certain content, because I do think you need a concept of content to solve the first two for each problems. Second question. Did I mean to assert that something is minimalist true just in case the person...
Regarded as sufficient for minimalist truth.
Right.
Okay, that it be properly assertable. Whether it's right. Sufficient is having, say, an appropriate attitude. So.
That seems really bad, because then I can't get that everything correspondence true is minimalist true. No. So I can't say that. So I need something like, just in case it is... somehow normatively, just in case it's somehow normatively appropriate for them to, no. Okay, Lionel's shaking his head, that's wrong. So there's some reason I haven't told you what it takes for something to be minimalist.
You should say
true.
It doesn't take anything.
Yeah.
Just saying you give me the sentence and I'll tell you what it takes to make it true.
Yeah.
That's the standard.
Yes. So it'd be very non-minimal to tell you that much about minimalist truth. So I'll reject Andre's suggestion that something is minimalist true in your mouth just in case you hold the attitude that makes it appropriate to assert. So
the attitude just drops out.
Right. So I'm going to call it minimalist true just in case I hold the attitude that makes it appropriate to assert, but I'm not going to give you sort of anything besides the T schemas.
Right.
Okay, we have a couple more people on the list, but I'm afraid we're out of time, so please join me in...